Looking good, Larry.
Looks nice, Larry. These guys know what they're doing.
Well, they worked for you before, so they got to know what they're doing.
Yeah. But we're going to do a lot.
Well, camera rolls.
Okay, you're running?
Yes, sir.
Larry, start at the beginning. Talk to me about growing up in Camden, what it was like as a young man, as a kid in that part of the South. Just talk to me about your earliest memories as a kid.
Well, I remember vividly where I was involved in baseball when I was like 9, 10 years old. We had a fellow in the town by the name of Richard DuBose, who had a T-model Ford, and he used to gather the kids together, and we played different teams around the city. And my father had played semi-pro ball with the team that Richard DuBose played for. And one of the things that I remember, and I had an opportunity in 98 to go back to Camden, South Carolina, there was a young lady that had played with us in the streets, and she came over to my aunt's home, and I hadn't seen her in, well, I guess 35 or 40 years, and she was so happy, and I was very happy to see her, and of course, she was a Caucasian lady, and you know, I always look at baseball as a situation where everybody can play it, and football and basketball, you can play football and basketball, but if you go back to that particular time, ladies were not involved in the football and basketball, and basketball in particular like they are now, but they were involved in baseball, what we call the stickball. I lived on the street with different nationalities. Certainly, you know, segregation-wise from the standpoint of movies or theaters, theaters and restaurants and that kind of situation wasn't available for me. But you know, when you're 9, 10 years old, you don't pay too much attention to that. Sometimes people think, well, because I came out of the South, that I didn't understand some of the problems that were going on, but I did understand some of the problems. But the interesting thing about growing up in Camden, South Carolina, was the fact that I got an opportunity to be involved in baseball, in grade school, in semi-pro baseball. And, you know, I think baseball was a thing that broadened my education, particularly my education of understanding people. And by being involved in different phases of dealing with people helped me a lot to be involved when I got the opportunity to play Major League Baseball as far as knowing people and getting along with people. I've always said that I think the toughest things for some of my teammates when I first got to Major League Baseball was the fact that they had not had the opportunity to associate with Afro-Americans before. Mm. And you know, you're sort of happy about the fact that you got the opportunity, because when some of the stories would go around where Afro-Americans had tails, when I go and took a shower, they didn't see any tails. Mm. So that gave them some kind of an education.
But let me ask you about your parents, because obviously your value system had a lot to do with your success. What did your parents teach you? What was the major influence on your life as a kid?
The one thing that, I lost my father when I was about 8 years old. And my mom was in the North, because at that particular time, the salary was a little different in the North than it were in the South. So I grew up, I was raised by an aunt and an uncle and a grandmother. And I think that the one thing that my grandmother taught me is respect, and people are human beings. Judge people on your own, not what somebody else may tell you or what you might read. It's very strict from the standpoint of believing in a supreme being. I always say that a lot of the things that happened to me in the early stages of baseball that I was able to adjust to or control to a certain extent is there was a strong feeling that God above was the reason why you did not get yourself involved in things that you could have. You know, like you slid into second base one day and God spit the back juice on me. Well, you know, you get up and walk away. Normally, a human being don't get up and walk away on that kind of situation. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you had to react, then of course it would have been out of baseball and you wouldn't have had the same opportunity. So I think the important thing being taught by my parents was the fact that you respect human beings and you judge people according. You be the judge of the people, not what somebody else might say.
But now you're in Camden, South Carolina. You're in grade school. You're in sixth grade. Tell me a little bit about what it was like, what the day was like. You went to school. You came home. Did you play ball in the afternoon? Who gave you your first glove? Who taught you how to hold a bat? You know, how did you learn baseball?
The one thing that I learned when I came home from school and a bunch of kids would get out in the street and play, my mom used to always tell me, or my grandmother used to always tell me, you have to sweep in front of the house. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, in that particular time here, there's no such thing as pavement. It's just dirt. So I would wear out about 2 brooms a month, and she could never understand why I wore so many brooms. But the broom was the bat.
Yeah.
So you know, if you're going to play with a bunch of kids and you got the bat, you're important. And you know, one of the things that I think that helped me a lot from a baseball standpoint is that I played with people that were much older than me. There were semi-pro teams in Camden. I'm like 8, 9, 10 years old, and I'm playing with the guys that are much older than I am. And I think by playing with those guys and playing often gave me, developed me quicker than maybe the person that did not play. In other words, if you look at a person who plays 6 months and then look at a person who plays 12 months, who starts out with the same ability, well, the guy who had more time playing will develop much quicker than the guy who had less of time playing. So I think from the time I was 8, 9, 10 years old, I was involved in baseball, and I think that's what gave me you got to have the ability. And I had a certain amount of ability, athletic ability.
Did you know then, Larry? Could you feel it? Could you sense it? The way you hit the ball, the way you were able to play the game? Did you know
you
had something?
You know, you're not saying it from a standpoint of a knowledge of it, but you're saying it because you did things and you played the game, and the thing that you did was like you didn't have to concentrate too much on doing it. There was a certain amount of instinct, reflex, and reaction that you got that gave you the idea that you could play. And then when you're playing against people that are older than you and you're playing as good as they're playing, then you knew that you had the ability. Not thinking that you're going to be a major league player, but just thinking the fact that you're going to play baseball, whether it be semi-pro or whatever it might be.
So you could always hit. I mean, when you played with those kids and they threw the ball real hard, you could always hit it.
Yeah, I was always quick enough to be involved in hitting the baseball, and which is probably one of the hardest things to do unless you're going to try to hit the golf ball straight, but it goes that way and it goes that way.
Now, did your father help you? Did he take you out and work with you? Who helped you along the way?
The person that helped me most in Camden was a fellow by the name of Richard DuBose that I mentioned before. My father passed when I was 8 years old, so I never got a chance to really remember too much about my father as far as helping me playing the game of baseball. But the fellow that lived in the town that had these kids come together to play baseball taught me a lot. And then, of course, when I got to high school in Paterson, New Jersey, I had a coach by the name of Al Livingston who helped me a lot. And I played semi-pro ball in Paterson, and a fellow by the name of Pat Wilson was involved, and he helped me a lot. But, you know, Faye and Claire, there's a lot of people that are involved in your life that help you develop, you know. So I can name a whole lot of people that had a lot to do with my development as far as the baseball is concerned. And you know, it's a funny thing. Baseball was a game that I loved to play. And my mother used to always tell me, get involved in sports. She never wanted me to play football. And I played 3 years of football before she found out about it. But she used to tell me, if you get him involved in sports, then you stay out of a lot of mischievous, a lot of trouble.
Larry, when did you come north, and how did your life change moving out of segregated South into?
I came north when I went to high school, my first year in high school. I went in Camden. I went to a missionary school, and when I finished grade school, I came north and lived with my mom. The segregation part was the same. There wasn't any difference, you know. You had segregation in the South and you had segregation in the North. It wasn't any different. But one of the interesting things about the segregation in the North and those in the South is that being on these different teams, high school teams, on a Saturday, you'd get together with the football team or the baseball team or the basketball team and you all go to movies. Well, we all walked because you didn't have money for a bus or your parents didn't have a car. So what would happen, we walked to the movies and we all lived in a mixed neighborhood in Patterson, is that they would go downstairs and I would go upstairs. Well, at that particular time, Afro-Americans couldn't sit downstairs in the movie. But the important thing, Commish and Claire, is that we all walked together and we all walked back home together.
But the team was segregated, right? When you were playing baseball in high school, was it an all-black team, or were you playing with white guys too?
No. You see, that's why I said earlier about I knew more about the Caucasian person than knew about me, because I was the only black kid on the baseball team, the only one on the basketball team, the only one on the football team. Now, the track team had a lot of Afro-Americans on it. So my thing was, and you know, it's a funny thing. You at that time, kids never looked at you in terms of making a judgment as far as the color is concerned. You know, I was, you know, being able, you know, Claire, and you both know that when you're in high school and you're involved in athletics, you're a big thing, you know. And people you saw, well, where'd you get the motivation from, you know, baseball-wise? Or when cheerleaders, you know, cheerleaders would motivate, you know, athletes in high school. And somebody said to me one time about, I hit well in Washington, D.C. And people said, well, why'd you hit, Washington, D.C. is a good ballpark for you to hit. Well, at that time, Afro-Americans only sit in center field and right field. And when I go out to center field, like in high school, you get all the cheer. It pumped you up. It made a lot of difference.
So what? Your memories, even though it was still a segregated world, were mostly pleasant of your high school days and...
High school days was prejudice. You know, we in 1941, we won the state championship in New Jersey high school. And the team that would win the state championship in New Jersey would play a team in Florida that won the state championship. And because of the segregation and because of I'm being the only Afro-American on the team, they postponed the game because at that time didn't play against a team. So that was a part of a learning lesson, for as I'm concerned, how much they appreciate me because they turned down the offer because I couldn't go, you know.
How did you deal with racism? How did you see it in those days, and how did you deal with it? I've always thought that religion played a big part in your attitude. How did that start? And how did you confront?
You know, one of the things, and I think at the time that I was involved in the early stages of game baseball, I didn't realize what the history would be. I knew things that I couldn't do. Bill Veeck, who, when I walked into his office, he had a scrapbook about that high. And from the day I was born until I walked in that office was what I had done. And one of the things that I think that I know for really helped, besides believing in a supreme being, is that he said to me, he said, you know, we're in this together. And then he started mentioning the fact the importance as far as the history is concerned. I had no knowledge of what the history was at that particular time. My thing was, I wanted to play baseball. And at the time, I never thought that I would get the opportunity. I thought I'd get the opportunity when Jackie signed in 1945 for Montreal. I was on an island called Ulithi in the South Pacific, and there were two Major League Baseball players on that island with me, one named Mickey Vernon, and the other fellow was a fellow by the name of Billy Goodman. So they knew that I had played in the Negro Leagues, and we used to go out on the island and throw batting packs at each other. And matter of fact, Mickey Verner turned my name into Mr. Griffey at the time, but at that time, Washington wasn't ready for Afro-American ball player.
And when you were a kid growing up, who were your heroes? Who did you look up to and say, these are people I really admire, whether in sports or outside of sports?
Faye, it's a tough question for me. Not a tough question, because if you think that you've been a part of Major League Baseball, there would have been some Major League player that you might admire. I had not too much knowledge of Major League players at that particular time, because I never went to a ball game. My family couldn't afford a radio to listen. So there were people in my school that I wanted to be like. And one fellow went to my high school named Bob Smith, Afro-American, great athlete. And you know, that's the kind of person that I wanted to be like. When I got to the Newark Eagles, playing against Josh and Satch and those guys, then all of a sudden you kind of want to be like those guys. And a lot of people say, well, you never had a major league player. And no, I didn't, because I never went to a game. And I used to sell newspapers, and I used to read about these different players, you know. But I never wanted to be like those players, because there weren't anybody representing Afro-Americans in Major League Baseball.
I was going to say, so you're growing up, you're a teenager, you know your own athleticism. How do you make the transition, teenager to Newark team? How does that work?
From the Newark Eagles to Major League Baseball?
No. How do you go into the Newark Eagles? How's that transition?
This is interesting. excuse me. I graduated high school in 1942, June 1942. And the Newark Eagles was playing in my hometown, playing a team called the Black Yankees. There was an umpire, that umpire in the Negro Leagues was from my hometown. And he suggested to Abe and Effie Manley to give me a tryout. So I went for a tryout, and I made the team. And they gave me $300 a month.
Tell us about that tryout. What was it like? Were you scared?
I think, Commissioner, when you have ability, you don't worry about, you know, failure. You know, your interest now is just get an opportunity. And I was up to here with ability and up to here with my belief.
Mm-hmm. And you were how old? You're 17, 18?
17. And when I went out there and started, I just looked at baseball as a game you played. And I was fortunate enough to have the ability to play the game. So yeah. I'm playing against guys that are much, much older than I am.
Second baseman, right?
And at that time, you know, not too many young Afro-Americans got the opportunity to play in the Negro Leagues, because when the Satches and the Joshes and the Buck Leonards and the Cool Papa Bell and all those guys are playing, they built a fan group. So for some young guy to come in, you know, the opportunity wasn't there like it would be in Major League Baseball. So and when I got the opportunity to play, and when they started saying $300 a month, and at the time my mom was a domestic worker, so she worked in Ridgewood. And I was living with a friend of hers, so it was $7 a week, you know, the room and board. As soon as I got $300, she stopped paying. I had to pay, but it was a interesting thing by getting the opportunity to play in the Negro Leagues at that time. And I had a scholarship to Long Island University, so at the end of the year, at the end of the baseball season, I enrolled in Long Island University. But when I was playing baseball after I got out of high school, I used the name of Larry Walker, and never thinking there would be a real Larry Walker in Denver, right? And when the season was over, I enrolled in Long Island University and was the sixth man on the basketball team. And then, of course, in December of that year, I got drafted into the service, so I never got a chance. But my thing was to go to Long Island University, to play baseball in the summer, and to come back to my high school to be a coach. I've always wanted, you know, to be that, be involved in athletics.
So in that short time before you were drafted, you're living the life as a Negro League ball player. Is that like being the king in your own backyard? How much esteem were the players held in Newark? Were you instant celebrity there?
Did they?
Were you an instant celebrity once you became a Newark Eagle? How did?
Yeah, I was, particularly in my hometown, you know. But when you went around the league, you all knew. So the Monty Irvins and the Lenny Pierce and those guys were the big guys. And then all of a sudden, here comes this little guy out of high school. And by playing well, I began to have a fan follower. You know, I tell you, Commissioner Clara, that I had a real good time playing in the Negro Leagues. Although, you know, segregation, whatever you might call it. But the idea that you're going to play baseball, an idea that you're fortunate enough to play the game of baseball, sort of got you away from thinking about, you know, the segregation. And you lived in the best hotels and you ate in the best restaurants as far as Afro-Americans are concerned. So you never, so it made it a little bit easier when you got to the major leagues because you had been through the same type of thing and you're going through the same type of thing in the major league. But you never thought or never was smart enough to realize justice for some and justice or justice for all. Your focus was on playing the game of baseball. And you had fun and you were happy. I was happy doing it.
Can we have a timeout?
Sure.
I want to take a minute because if you think for
only part of the
okay, minute. Can we go back?
We should probably wait until the phone conversation is over.
Okay.
Just so that you know, we have about 10 minutes left on this tape.
The only part of
then we'll change tape again.
Claire, the only part of the Major League barnstorming that I never barnstormed against Caucasian Americans.
Okay. Did you play in the major?
See, what Jackie would do would form two teams.
Okay.
And they were all out of the Negro Leagues. So we'd play against each other.
Okay.
But I never had the opportunity to play
against. Feller did that later on, but he was already a.
Yeah.
You were already.
Now, Satch and Bob Feller did a lot of that, but okay. I never was involved in that.
Were you involved in any of the games in Yankee Stadium or Comiskey
we,
Park?
You know, we used to have a thing in Yankee Stadium and Polo Grounds and Ebbets Field. It's called a two-team doubleheader.
Oh, okay.
So it would be the Newark Eagles against the Baltimore Eli Giants. So you would have Larry Doby, Monty Irvin, Roy Campanella, Joe Black, and Drew Gilliam.
That's great. That's
yeah,
great.
And then the second game would be like the Kansas City Monarchs against the Philadelphia Stars. So the Kansas City Monarchs would have Satchel Paige and a fellow by the name of Hank Thompson. And the Philadelphia Athletics had a fellow by the name of Harry Simpson.
Yeah, I remember. They
so,
all played, yeah.
Yeah, and that's when you get 40,000 people.
Are we back?
See, that's a great story.
Majority of them were Afro-Americans in shirt and tie and hat. I mean,
that's
sharp.
Great. That's
yeah.
great. That's what I mean.
You ready? Let's go back and talk about the Negro Leagues, Larry. Tell us what it was like. What were the teams like? Where did you play? Paint a picture of the Negro Leagues.
Even before some of us got the opportunity to play in Major League Baseball, we had played in stadiums like the Yankee Stadium and Polo Grounds and Ebbets Field and Comiskey Park and Griffith Stadium. And what they would have is, you would call it a two-team doubleheader. When the Yanks are out of town, like say this Sunday coming, we would play in the Yankee Stadium and you'd play against Newark Eagles against the Baltimore Eli Giants, and you'd have people like Monty Irvin, myself, Campanella, Joe Black, Junior Gilliam. And then the second game would be the Monarchs against the Philadelphia Stars. And the Monarchs would have Satchel Paige and a fellow by the name of Hank Thompson, and then another fellow by the name of Harry Simpson, all got major league situation. And then, of course, the Homestead Grays would play the Newark Eagles. You'd have Josh Gibson and Buck Leonard and Coop Papa Bell. And you'd have like 45,000 people. That's why sometimes I think, and I think a lot of people think the same way, that Mr. Ricky saw more than just players. And that's business, you know. If you get 40,000 Afro-Americans in the stadium, that's if it's only a dollar a head, that's $40,000, you know. But the thing that was interesting is that the dress, you know, the shirt, the tie, the hat, and most of the Afro-American that was at the ballpark just came from church. And, you know, they go to church at 11 o'clock. The game started at 1, so they're in the ballpark. And, you know, if you look at some of the old clippings of people, even major leagues, they're all dressed nice, you know. And not nothing against people today, the way they dress, that's fine. But that was a part of the so-called luxury thing for Afro-Americans at that particular time, because you go to church and then you come to the ballpark, and it, you know, it didn't cost a lot of money. And you would enjoy, you know, the seeing these different people play. I think that Afro-Americans, as far as the Negro Leagues are concerned, were great contributors to the Negro League baseball because they were great supporters and great rooters. They root for you like mad. And I remember in 1946 when the Newark Eagles won the Negro World Series, we beat Satchel Paige 2-2 and 2-1. And what they would do is they would have the game, one game in Newark, they have another game in New York, they have another game in Philadelphia, and they have another game in Washington. By going around in different cities, they would draw more people. And one of the things that was so great about it is that Satch was sort of a promoter, a market man, or whatever you want to call it. And he would fill the station. He would fill the station. And you know, he was the kind of a guy that would say, "Well, I'm going to throw you a fastball," you know. And he'd throw you the fastball. And he, you know, it's a funny thing. People talk about the pitching aspect, in particular Satchel Paige. You got to stay low, you got to stay high. Satch just stayed low all the time. Just threw the ball low. Satch, you probably have seen the kid from Boston.
Martinez.
Pedro.
Yeah.
Yeah, Pedro. Same kind of a movement on the pitch.
Yeah.
And finger-wise, if you notice how long Pedro's fingers are, Satch's finger was long like that, and a thin hand, and just a nice, easy movement.
Tell us about the Negro League, the culture. When you went on the road, you guys had to have a certain kind of dress. Tell us what it was like, the older guys. What was life like in the Negro League?
I always said it was fun. And I think most of the guys that played in the Negro League at that time was fun. Because, you know, Claire and Commission, you